High expectations in Paris, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Global Climate Summit is underway in Paris, and there's hope for a deal that can last.
There's definitely a mood that this conference is going to be the turning point for addressing climate change.
Also, some say the man who attacked a Planned Parenthood clinic in Colorado is a domestic terrorist, but prosecutors may decide not to use that term in court.
To bring in a domestic terrorism charge means that prosecutors actually have to figure out what his motive was.
Plus, how retiring Lakers star Kobe Bryant will be remembered by basketball fans worldwide.
He's a legend. Even if you're a Celtics fan or a Clippers fan, a Knicks fan, that is something probably in the States is not so clear about him.
Those stories today on The World. Thank you for being with us. Paris continues its sad recovery from the violent attacks there a little over 2 weeks ago, and now world leaders are gathering in the French capital for a summit on global climate change. That's added to the security concerns, and we'll get to that in a few minutes. But let's start with the climate summit, and hear some of what President Obama had to say today in Paris. He told everyone assembled that there's no time to waste.
For I believe, in the words of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., that there is such a thing as being too late. And when it comes to climate change, that hour is almost upon us. But if we act here, if we act now, if we place our own short-term interests behind the air that our young people will breathe and the food that they will eat and the water that they will drink and the hopes and dreams that sustain their lives, then we won't be too late for them.
Anon Verchot is a French-American journalist with our WGBH partners at the Ground Truth Project here in Boston, and she's in Paris this week for the Climate Summit. What is the mood today, Manon? How are people feeling as this conference finally gets underway?
I think there's a mood of hope, especially as leaders come together after the Paris attacks. They're seeing this as a moment to move forward. Everyone's talking about Paris as a turning point for addressing climate change.
Right. And meantime, there are thousands of soldiers and police patrolling the streets of Paris. How is that making people feel?
There is a lot of tension there. A lot of roads have been shut down, especially as the presidents and leaders of around the world have come in. But Paris is trying to get back to normal. People are trying to go back to their daily lives, despite the strong military and police presence.
I mean, interesting that you note the leaders coming into Paris right now, because with the mostly failed Copenhagen meeting 6 years ago, heads of state showed up in the last days of the conference. I gather the plan this time was to get pretty much all leaders, like 150 of them, early on in the proceedings in Paris, build up momentum. Has that happened?
Yes, there's definitely a lot of momentum. There's a lot of excitement with all the leaders here. They all came together and made their statements earlier today to show their support for addressing climate change. And there have also been major announcements in terms of how much money is going to be given to renewable energy development. So by showing their support, the leaders of the world have shown that they care about this issue and that something has to be done.
So we heard from President Obama a moment ago, and other leaders are picking up his cue that he mentioned in that clip, that there's really a generation gap with this crisis, that climate change is a problem created by older generations, is now being handed off to a younger generation, people like yourself. So as a young journalist and a young French citizen, does that feel like a burden, or are you optimistic?
I think there's a bit of both. It is very much a young person's issue. We're really definitely going to be the ones who are affected most by climate change. But young people are not necessarily sure that the climate change conference will necessarily bring about measures or necessary emissions reductions to address climate change or to limit global warming.
I mean, Paris is a tough backdrop for all this because terrorism, extremism, and the fallout from conflicts around the world is also a huge challenge to your generation. Do these dual challenges compete for, you know, the emotional and professional attention of you and your peers?
There were definitely concerns when the Paris attacks happened that they would overshadow the Paris conference. But Hollande, the president of France this morning, said that he could not separate the war on terror from the war on climate because they're just so interlinked. And I think many young people understand that.
Manon Verchot there with our partners at the Ground Truth Project. She's at the Climate Summit in Paris. The deadly attacks in the French capital earlier this month put the country on a war footing. Add 40,000 visitors to the city for the summit, including more than 100 world leaders, and you've got a very complex challenge. Police have said security concerns would trump free speech. That supposedly means no marches, no rallies, but activists said they would not be silenced, and over the weekend, they made themselves heard. Here's Jacob Resnick in Paris.
The mass march planned for Sunday was banned by authorities after the deadly attacks here. So instead, thousands of people formed a 2-mile-long human chain through central Paris to demonstrate their support for action against climate change. France has been under a state of emergency since November 13th, but police and activists kept the conversation going.
Our first thing was to meet with the authority and to say, okay, we understand what we're not allowed to, but what are we allowed actually to do?
That's Audrey Arjun, an activist with Peuples Solidaires. She said that police gave their tacit approval for Sunday's human chain as long as people stayed on the sidewalk.
And then we thought, okay, let's play with that. And we are also allowed to dress as we want, right? So let's put our placards on, our messaging on. And then at the end, we have a perfectly legal way of expressing ourselves.
But not all demonstrators respected the truce. As many were heading home, a smaller group converged on Republic Square to march. They were met by riot police. Throngs of demonstrators chanted slogans accusing France of becoming a police state and hurled rocks, bottles, and other objects at police, who retaliated with tear gas and baton charges before making more than 300 arrests. A day earlier, Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius had defended France's blanket ban on protests. Speaking through an interpreter, he responded to critics who questioned why rallies were banned when soccer games and Christmas markets are still permitted.
If they are, in fact, in a closed environment, of course, we can guarantee a certain amount of safety and security. But if you've got thousands of people walking or marching, of course, there are risks that we may not be able to manage quite in the same way.
But the French government's actions go further than just banning demonstrations. The country remains under a 3-month state of emergency, and the government has hinted it wants to go further by amending the constitution to make its powers permanent. Clemence Bechtard is a staff attorney with the Paris-based International Federation for Human Rights.
There have been a lot of proposals, each more frightening than the other one.
Already, the expanded powers allow police to restrict people's liberty on mere suspicion of bad intent. That's exactly what happened last week to Joël Dumanjout, who has been placed under house arrest for the duration of the climate conference. Police have ordered him to register 3 times a day at a nearby police station and not to leave his neighborhood. Dumanjout is known to police because he represented a group of activists challenging the ban on marches. He says police told him it's simply too dangerous to allow public gatherings.
So what I was answering is, how long will it be? 3 months? 3 years?
Human rights lawyers like Clemence Bechtard warn that France may be moving too quickly to restrict freedoms. She recounts how critical French society was of the United States in the wake of 9/11, when the Bush administration shepherded in the controversial Patriot Act that expanded police powers.
This is the obvious comparison. France having so much denounced the adoption of these laws in the U.S. and now doing exactly the same thing 14 years afterwards.
That said, the French government has been buoyed by public support for its tough stance in the wake of the deadly attacks. Despite her personal reservations, politically speaking, Bechtard admits it's been an effective strategy.
People are really petrified. And we see this in the polls. Again, the tremendous support of the population in favor of all the measures that have been taken so far.
The need for extraordinary security is especially high this week, with nearly 150 world leaders attending the climate conference. So for now, Paris treads an uncomfortable line, balancing the demands of 2 global crises, preventing another attack while respecting free speech on the climate crisis. For The World, I'm Jacob Resnick, Paris.
The Mideast is changing and changing fast. Syria might be the worst-case scenario of that change, but Yemen is also part of the unstable jigsaw puzzle. Reporter Sharif Abdel-Quddus was recently in Yemen, and he's been writing about the civilian victims of the Saudi-led bombing campaign there for our partners at Global Post.
Just going around the country provides a panorama of the destruction. You can see homes, schools, mosques, bridges, restaurants, pharmacies, hospitals have all been hit. And the United Nations itself says that the majority of civilian casualties in Yemen have been caused by these airstrikes.
Let's talk about some of what you investigated with those airstrikes and the civilian casualties. One story in particular that I'd like you to tell us, it begins at a wedding.
That's right. This was on October 7th in a small village called Sanaben. And three brothers of the Sanabeni family were getting married in a joint ceremony. just after 9:30 p.m., people had heard fighter jets overhead, but they weren't very worried because despite the fact that Yemen had been bombed on a near daily basis for what was then 7 months, Seniban had never been hit before, and so people dismissed it. But a missile smashed into the three-story family home, killing 43 people, most of them from the groom's and bride's families, including one of the groom's and one of the bride's.
It just sounds like such a horrific, horrific moment at this event that's supposed to be celebratory. You spoke with survivors. How is the family dealing with this?
They tell you of who they lost, and it's almost hard for me as a reporter to fathom it. One of the grooms, the middle brother, was the one I spoke to the most. You know, it was very hard for him to even get the words out. A lot of his relatives were saying that he's not altogether there anymore. He kind of had this mid-distance stare that never really focused on you. And, you know, he found out one by one on the night of the incident. He was inside the house. He had just left his new bride, his 18-year-old wife, and walked up the stairs when the missile hit. And he found out that night that his wife had died, his younger brother, who was also one of the groomsmen, his younger sister, his father, and his mother were all killed.
Wow.
And for him, you know, it was hard for him to describe what he was feeling. The most poignant thing he said was, it would have been better if I had died like them. It would have been better if I had burned like them.
We've reported, Sharif, on the U.S. backing of the Saudi air campaign and naval blockade. Did you speak with the survivors in this family about those connections? And what have they said to you about the U.S. role?
Yeah, look, you know, first of all, when you're in Yemen, a lot of people, especially victims of violence, victims of airstrikes, are very keen to talk to journalists. They really want to get their story out. They believe that if people truly understand what was happening to them on the ground, that enough pressure would be brought to bear to make it stop. And they are very aware that the United States is involved in this conflict, that the United States is backing the Saudi-led coalition. Many of them wanted to send messages saying that, you know, just tell people what's happening here on the ground. Tell people that civilians are dying.
Is it possible for you, Sharif, to assess how the deaths of civilians in Yemen has made some moderate civilians less moderate and perhaps even more extreme in their views of the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and the West?
Well, certainly, you know, we've seen in conflict after conflict that there's going to be some kind of blowback. Ayman al-Salabani, you know, the groom that I just spoke to you about, who lost, you know, everything, most of his family, lost his wife, lost his brother. You know, he told me that he now wants to become a martyr against Saudi Arabia. He didn't mention the United States specifically, but people in Yemen have been living under this constant bombardment for 8 months now. And they really feel that the international community has forsaken them and that the global media has largely ignored them.
Sharif Abdel-Kudus with our partners at Global Post. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can read Sharif's full report about airstrikes in Yemen at PRI.org. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're going to hear now about two linguists divided by one huge cultural barrier. And here's the twist. Each of these linguists studies and teaches the other's native language. In a few minutes, we'll hear about one of them, a Palestinian who teaches Hebrew to students in Gaza. But first, reporter Shana Shealy has this profile of the Israeli linguist.
Arik Sidan is Jewish. He's tall, with light skin, blue eyes, and rosy cheeks. And he really loves the Arabic language.
هل زرت إسرائيل هذه السنة؟
Here he is teaching an Arabic class in Jerusalem. Sudan's research specialty is Arabic's use of the subjunctive, something he just happens to be one of the world's authorities on. Yeah, he's pretty nerdy. Sudan chose to study Arabic in seventh grade. He was lucky to have an inspirational teacher, a man who Sudan says lived the language.
He brought a finjan, which is Arabic coffee, and he drank it with a lot of noise, something like... Everyone laughed, and then he expected the laughter, and then he said, what are you laughing about? This is the way Arabs drink. They enjoy coffee, not like you Jews.
After his first Arabic lesson, the 12-year-old Sudan made a toy out of plastic googly eyes glued onto cardboard in a fuzzball. He gave it to his mother, Drora, after writing an inscription in two languages.
It so surprised me. Not that he wrote in Hebrew, for my mother with love. But in Arabic, it's was very unusual. Why in Arabic?
Drora says other family members and friends have questioned his decision to study and then make a career out of Arabic.
They know him, that he can study whatever he likes. They always say, so it's not the only Arabic, yes? No, I told them, the grammar of Arabic.
Not just the language, but how it works. That has been Sadan's interest, and how close it is to his native tongue, Hebrew. The two languages share many root words and follow similar grammatical patterns. Sadan says he was lucky to learn Arabic in the 80s, when Jews and Arabs had more chances to meet. Now, though, the status of Arabic has changed. Although it's an official language in Israel, fewer Jewish Israelis study it. Sadan believes that Jews are turning their backs on a language that used to be central to their culture.
1,000 years ago, Jews and Arabs worked together, compared the biblical scriptures, discussed things in Arabic. If a person says that Arabic is a lousy language, it means that the heritage of this person, the Jewish person, is also lousy. Because the Jewish heritage, a great percentage of it, is Arabic.
Today, Sadan's Jewish students learn Arabic for all kinds of reasons. 26-year-old Yonatan, he doesn't want his last name used. He first studied it in high school so he could do intelligence during his mandatory army service.
The way they teach Arabic in the army, it's actually for know thy enemy in order for you to be able to stop the next explosion or something like that. They always say that. You tend to forget that it's a language. It's something that has to do with people.
After he finished his army service, Yonatan went to university and met Arabs in Sudan's syntax class. And he changed.
Until that time, I always thought of them as the Arabs that hate Jews. And because I learned that there's a different Arab, I saw the need for me to learn the language and to see what they really think. And if they do think badly of us, then maybe I could influence them and convince them otherwise.
That's the kind of attitude Sudan is trying to foster in his students. You can't be a good linguist, he says, if your starting point is to stereotype groups of people.
I think it's important that an opinion which is really racist is to say all Jews are or all Arabs are. It doesn't make sense. In languages, you can never say always it's like this or never it's like this. Languages are like life.
Sudan can't always get visas to travel to conferences abroad, especially in parts of the Arab world where Israelis are not welcome, even experts on Arabic. And he gets it. Many Israeli Arabic speakers who look like him learned Arabic for security and intelligence, so he understands that colleagues abroad may be suspicious of him. But Sadan just wishes more Israeli Jews would embrace this fascinating language.
I sometimes say as a joke or as a bad joke or sad joke that I only wish that the Hebrew people and the Arab people would be a bit close as the languages, only 10% close as the languages are.
At home in Israel, too, Sadan says he sometimes feels intimidated. I ask him who he feels intimidated by.
By people around me, Jewish people. Today, unlike 10 or 20 or 30 years ago, the Arabic language is considered the language of the enemy. And if you speak Arabic, it might necessarily mean that you are a part of the enemy, which is ridiculous.
Earlier this year, Sadan made a presentation at a conference in Belgium. There was a scholar there from Lebanon. The two bonded over, what else? Language. The Lebanese linguist had found some ancient Hebrew manuscripts in a library in Beirut. Sadan helped him translate them, and after that they vowed to stay in touch. They exchanged email addresses. Gmail, of course. Writing to each other's institutional addresses might cause trouble. They laughed about the underhand arrangement, but it was a poignant moment. The recognition that even the most innocent trading of linguistic ideas was subject to the rules of the Arab-Israeli conflict. For The World, I'm Shana Sheely.
And Patrick Cox of our language podcast, The World in Words, joins me now. And in your podcast, Patrick, you feature a Palestinian linguist who teaches Hebrew, right?
That's right, yeah. His name is Sobi Bahul, and he's the best-known Hebrew teacher in Gaza. As you can imagine, I mean, the circumstances for teaching and learning Hebrew in Gaza are, well, they're unique. For example, how do you get to practice your language skills in a place that's sealed from Israel?
Yeah.
In fact, one of the last times there was any sustained contact between Israelis and Palestinians in Gaza. That was more than a decade ago. And Bahul has got a great story about this. He was renovating his apartment, and so he had all of this trash outside of his place. And this was at a time when the Israeli army, which was occupying Gaza, they had this policy of cleaning up the streets. So that's what they did when they came to Bahul's apartment. With all of this additional trash from the renovation, they told him to clean it up. And the confrontation was pretty tense initially. But here's how he responded.
I started to speak Hebrew. Rega, as he said to me, just a minute, do you speak Hebrew? Yes, I speak Hebrew. I am a Hebrew teacher. Really? Yes. Where did you learn? How did you learn? And one of them, the leader of the group, he said, okay, you go and collect all the people and let them clean it.
Wow. Shows you what can happen when you actually make an attempt to learn a language. It can melt a lot of things.
Absolutely. And actually, it led to a lasting relationship. These Israeli soldiers, whenever they were in the neighborhood, they would swing by and drink a cup of coffee and speak some Hebrew.
It sounds as though the reasons the Palestinians would learn Hebrew can be very different from why an Israeli would learn Arabic.
Yeah, I mean, one immediately thinks, just as we heard in the piece, that people are learning for military or paramilitary reasons. But those are by no means the only reasons. There was one woman, one of Bahul's students, whenever she wanted to buy shampoo, she'd be frustrated because the labels on her shampoo were all in Hebrew. And she had dry hair and she wanted to get the right stuff. And so she determined that she would learn Hebrew so she could actually treat her hair correctly.
So whether it's talking to the police or buying shampoo, I mean, underlying these two linguists, I would imagine, is just an attempt to truly kind of understand the other side. Well, you can hear more about language learning in the Middle East in the latest edition of the World in Words podcast, which you can find at iTunes or at PRI.org/language. Patrick, thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Marco.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. America isn't the only place where abortion clinics are controversial. This counselor at a clinic in Northern Ireland says she's got protesters outside her window every day.
Usually there's two or three people there, and we did have a couple of clients in today, so they would have harassed them on the way in and on the way out.
That's coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Last Friday, shootings at a Planned Parenthood clinic in Colorado Springs left three people dead and nine wounded. Local police are refusing to suggest any motive for the shootings, but law enforcement sources have told various news outlets that the suspect, 57-year-old Robert Deere, made remarks about no more baby parts to investigators after his surrender. U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch called the attack a crime against women receiving health care services. Republican presidential candidate Mike Huckabee called it domestic terrorism. So how do we label what happened in Colorado Springs? Juliet Kayyem knows a thing or two about terrorism. She's a former assistant secretary with the Department of Homeland Security and now an analyst with our partners here at WGBH. Some people are calling the shooting in Colorado Springs terrorism, some for political reasons, others to make a point. You spent a lot of time thinking about this. What is your definition, Juliet?
Well, what you label what happened here at the Planned Parenthood depends on the audience. From my perspective, the term domestic terrorism is a legal term, and it seems to me that what Robert Deere did satisfied every aspect of that definition, which is the unlawful use of force or violence committed by a group of two or more individuals against persons or property to intimidate or coerce a government, the civilian population, or any, and then it goes on. And so whether he was formally part of a group or inspired by a group will be what has to be proved in court. But, and the big but is this, while I believe this is domestic terrorism, I also have no problem if he is put before a court for mere murder.
So what you just kind of paraphrased there, is that the federal legal definition of terrorism or domestic terrorism?
That is. That's the FBI's formal definition. We tend to think of terrorism in the United States only as terrorism perpetuated by radical extremists of the Islamic faith. Nothing could be further from the truth. Our statutes actually do cover domestic and international terrorism. And unfortunately, the United States has a long history of domestic terrorism, including the Oklahoma City bombings in the 1990s.
So for the purposes of this conversation, Juliet, just go over for us what the key criteria are that could make the Colorado Springs shooting a terrorism case.
So essentially, at least by news reports, Deere was a man who harbored political motivations for numerous weird behaviors in his life. He is alleged to have said to the police officers when he was finally captured something about President Obama, but more significantly, something about, you know, now baby body parts will no longer be harvested. It was clearly a reference to a big controversy in which someone from Planned Parenthood was taped, unbeknownst to her, talking about the harvesting of fetal organs and tissue for scientific purposes. It ended up being a big political brouhaha, of which many people running for president on the Republican side are using to argue that those who support pro-choice are supporting the harvesting of babies.
Right. And again, just to be clear, none of this has been proven yet.
Right. So this is just what we're hearing was said to the police officers, confirmed by a number of media outlets. And this is exactly why lawyers and prosecutors may feel very comfortable simply bringing a murder case. Because if I have all the evidence I need to put this guy behind bars so he never sees the light of day again, why do I want to get into this debate about whether he liked or didn't like Planned Parenthood or whether he liked or didn't like President Obama? I, right now, as a prosecutor, thinking about this case, as someone who knows a lot about counterterrorism cases, showing motivation is difficult in court. When you have the evidence before you, sometimes, you know, not calling him a domestic terrorist is actually the most justice for the victims.
Do you feel there's a moral argument to applying the word terrorism to what happened in Colorado Springs?
I do. And I actually, that's why I feel comfortable, you know, focusing on who the audience is for what we call these things. As someone who's a terrorism expert, to me, this is clearly an act of domestic terrorism meant to influence and intimidate the lawful actions of a population, in particular women seeking health and reproductive rights. So I feel very comfortable calling this domestic terrorism, both as a moral necessity and descriptive, but also to remind people in the United States that if we too closely align terrorism with a certain kind of radical Islam, we actually may miss a lot of threats to our safety and security.
Former counterterrorism official Juliet Kayyem there. America is not the only country where family planning and abortion rights are a highly divisive issue. Take Northern Ireland. Today, the High Court there ruled that parts of a local law forbidding abortion are a violation of human rights. Unlike other parts of the United Kingdom, termination of a pregnancy is currently illegal in Northern Ireland, except in very limited circumstances. Heather Lowe is a counselor at the Family Planning Association in the capital, Belfast. The organization advises young women who are seeking an abortion.
We have protesters outside our building every day of the week. So they're here from early in the morning until we go home in the evening. Once they establish that the woman is coming to us, then on the way out, they would follow them, harass them, talk to them about murdering their babies. They're never going to recover if they have an abortion, making all sorts of assumptions about what they're actually doing here in the first place. And so women would suffer a lot from the protesters. Our policy in the FPA is non-engagement. So we don't talk with them. They don't talk with us. We just come and go from the building. It would be the women using the service that would suffer mainly from the protesters.
And has that harassment turned into violence ever?
Yes, well, we do. We actually have a case running at the minute where one of our admin staff was assaulted last year by one of the protesters, and we're actually waiting any day now on the outcome of that case. So she left the building. The protesters didn't know her because she was a new member of staff, followed her down the street, same kind of behaviour, shoving leaflets into her bag. And when she refused to engage with them, she was hit with a clipboard by one of the protesters. So, as I say, that's in court at the minute.
Wow. And Heather, those protesters were out there today?
Yes, they were outside today. Usually there's two or three people there. And we did have a couple of clients in today, so they would have harassed them on the way in and on the way out. They know the hours that we offer the counselling service, so they would come. Our first session is at 10 in the morning, so they would usually arrive about 10, maybe 10:45 to catch women leaving. And they know when we work on the evenings. So they also phone up and book appointments. I mean, we know that they do that and then cancel the appointments at the last minute. So they just do anything really to try and disrupt the service that we provide.
What is your reaction to the shooting at the Planned Parenthood in Colorado on Friday?
Well, I mean, obviously it's tragic. It's a tragic thing to have happened to anyone. I would hate to think that would happen here. Our argument is that staff should be allowed to come and go freely in their workplace without threat or fear of violence. So I would apply the same to anywhere in the world, really. We should all be able to go to work during the day and come home again at night without being worried about being attacked or threatened or and in this situation shot.
Have you ever yourself been threatened?
I did have one woman approach me when I was in the shops away from work one day, coming up telling me that I was a bad person and she knew what I was doing and all of this stuff, you know, but I just carried on with my shopping.
Do you find it hard to just carry on with daily life when you have people saying things like that or even just knowing kind of what the attitudes are out there?
No, because I think the reality for me is that they don't really understand what it is we're doing here, what we offer as a counselling service. So women come in and, like I said earlier, they get the opportunity to talk through their options and that they get to the place they need to be with the choice they need to make. I have no investment in what the outcome is, whether that's abortion, adoption or continuing into parenthood. As long as the woman gets to the place that she needs to be, that's the most important thing. And I think that all of the women that we see will say at the end of every session, I'm really glad I came. I feel really sure now. I feel really clear about what I want to do. And that for me is what we're here to do. We're here to provide that service. So I know what we do is provide a vital service for women. So I'm very comfortable with that.
Heather Lowe, one of the counsellors at the Family Planning Association in Belfast in Northern Ireland. Thank you for your time today.
You're welcome.
Back in September, we brought you the story of a refugee family from Syria. They had resettled in the rural town of Turlock, California. That's about 2 hours east of San Francisco. Last week, the world's Monica Campbell went back to see how the family's doing.
When I last saw the family, Yassim Al-Hamad, the dad, was about to take his driver's test. Well, good news, he passed. As we pull up, so does Yassim, driving his minivan. I asked him if the test was easy.
Yes, it is easy. Yeah.
He got three wrong, only.
He only got three wrong?
Mm-hmm.
Baby steps into a new life in the U.S. after fleeing war in Syria. It took Yassim, his wife, Wahid Al-Khalifa, and their kids nearly 3 years to be resettled here. Now, after that long wait, life is full steam ahead. The kids are in school, learning fast. Arwa is 8 and in 4th grade.
How was school today?
Good. Because I passed the test.
Which test?
About multiplication. Easy, easy.
Really?
The parents are also learning English classes in the mornings.
ABC, he, who, he,
chi,
mechanic, insurance, gas.
When I first met Yassim, he was working at a halal slaughterhouse. But since then, he's decided he needs to learn English first. So they're receiving food stamps and other public assistance. And Yassim, who's 35, has a goal.
I like to have a farm.
Yes.
I dream to have a farm.
Cows, goats, chickens, like he had back in Syria before they fled, before their home was destroyed. Their friendships here in the U.S. are also deepening.
The people that I met here, they are more than friends. They are like brothers. They are always support me and help me.
His wife, Wajid, then walks in with her neighbor, Kifa Aziz.
We became best friends since she moved here.
But they're also learning about the harsh realities of America and its politics. They're keeping up on the 27 U.S. governors who oppose taking in Iraqi and Syrian refugees. They worry the pushback will slow their other relatives, a brother and nephew, hoping to come next from Syria.
It's going to make it difficult and harder for people. For example, my brother, I told my brother it's going to take like 5-7 months. But after what happened, I told him, hey, it might take a year, 2 years.
Wajid says that now they're telling their family that after Paris, it's going to be very difficult. It might take much longer to get here. They also don't understand the questioning now over security and refugees. The family's process was long. They waited in Jordan nearly 3 years. There were many interviews and background checks. They asked me questions for a year and a half, Yasim says. When did my parents die? Where? Do I have any wounds? Was I in the army? When? Where? He remembers one interview with a U.S. official lasting hours. And since Paris, they feel a shift. Wahid says people stare at her when they wouldn't before.
Yes. You've noticed people looking at you differently.
Yes, different than before. No, it wasn't like this. But since Paris, what happened in Paris, things changed.
Her husband, Yasim, hopes things change soon.
Yes.
He says, I hope this time will pass. I hope for peace soon in Syria and all over the world. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell, Turlock, California.
To follow the family's trek from Syria to the United States, we've created a map. You can check it out at PRI.org. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. As the civil war in Syria grinds on, more and more people are forced to flee their homes. They're hoping to get to more peaceful, more stable places in Europe and the U.S. Many Syrians, though, are being stopped at the borders because, very simply, they're not from there. So let's talk about those borders. What are they exactly? Not surprisingly, people don't agree on the definition of what a border really is. My next guest has been thinking about this a lot. Atousa Araxia Abrahamian is the author of a new book, an essay, really, called The Cosmopolites, The Coming of the Global Citizen. Thanks very much for being with us, Atousa. Let me ask you first about your own background and what got you thinking about borders and citizenship in the first place.
So I come from a very international background. I grew up going to international schools. My parents worked at the UN, and I have had three citizenships for as long as I can remember. So I'm a Swiss citizen, an Iranian citizen. My parents were born in Iran. And I'm also Canadian because I was born in Canada and I grew up in Geneva. So this idea that of one person having one citizenship and feeling bound to one nation was never intuitive to me. I'd always felt a little scattered and a little stateless. And I became interested in this idea of citizenship being something less, something more flexible and less fixed, you know, growing up. And then as a reporter, I discovered that there was actually a big market for buying and selling passports, which seems to reinforce this idea that maybe citizenship is not as inherently meaningful as people make it out to be. Maybe it is a little bit more arbitrary. Maybe it's not deserved. Maybe it's not something that you are stuck with your whole life.
Let's talk about the purchase of passports, the purchase of citizenship. I mean, you checked out these passport conventions. What happens at these gatherings and who goes there?
Yes, these passport conventions, they brand themselves as global citizenship junkets. So rather than buying a citizenship or buying a passport, which sounds a little bit shady, it sounds like something, you know, James Bond villain would do, you're becoming a global citizen. The way that these conferences are set up, I mean, really, they're quite ordinary. It's in a conference room, you know, a lot of tax lawyers and whatnot. And countries will present their citizenship as a commodity. And they will say, okay, this is why our country is a good place to be a citizen. St. Kitts and Nevis has a really huge passport business.
They're in the Caribbean.
In the Caribbean, yeah. I think a couple of years ago, something like a quarter of their GDP came from the sale of citizenship.
Wow.
Which is astonishing, and it's really helped their economy. But so the prime minister or a representative would go on stage and say, well, we have very low taxes, we have a very stable government, we have beautiful beaches. If you buy a condo worth $400,000, you can have a passport for free, essentially, as well. So it's a kind of a dog and pony show. They present their commodities to a large crowd of accountants, lawyers, bankers, people who work for the very rich.
Yeah, but it's not right. It's not the desperate people who are honestly in search of another place to live. It's billionaires who are getting these passports.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's now very well known that refugees from the Middle East and Africa take these arduous journeys to get asylum in Europe. But what most people don't know is that a millionaire, a billionaire from Libya can become an EU citizen in under a year just by investing in Malta, which sells its nationality for a little over $1 million.
So what does it tell us about the kind of artificiality of citizenship?
Well, I think that it tells us a little bit more about the artificiality of borders and how they apply a lot more to the poor than to the rich. I suppose the thesis of the Cosmopolites is that borders are alive and well, but for a price, you can flatten them.
Journalist Atoussa Araxia Abrahamian is the author of The Cosmopolites, The Coming of the Global Citizen. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Marco.
Finally today, let's talk a bit about Kobe Bryant. After 20 years in the NBA, the Los Angeles Lakers superstar has announced that this season will be his last one. I remember back when Kobe came into the league, he famously declared he was not going to be the next Michael Jordan. Instead, he would be Kobe. And through the years, I've watched him break all kinds of records, and I've also watched him court controversy. One thing is for sure, Kobe's leaving the league with the NBA penetrating more countries and cultures around the world than ever before. Davide Chinelato is a sports reporter with La Gazzetta dello Sport in Milan, Italy. Would you say Kobe is Mr. Basketball for the world, Davide?
Hi, yeah, I think so. He has been Mr. Basketball probably for the past 15 years, and especially here in Italy, where everyone remembered that he grew up here, that he was here for so long with his dad, and he actually still speaks today a pretty good Italian. And last year, when he passed Michael Jordan, who was first his muse, then his mentor, for third of a role in the NBA's current list, well, that just add more to his legacy.
Just remind us of his pedigree and how Kobe came into the league with this kind of global view of the sport.
If you consider that when he was here, he was playing more football, more soccer football than basketball. You understand that he has this whole different perspective, you know. He grew up not idolizing basketball players, but football players. And he grew up an AC Milan fan. You know, then he moved back to the States and, of course, fell in love so deeply with basketball, as he so wonderfully said in that farewell letter. Yeah, I mean, everyone remembers when he went to Beijing for the Olympics, he was the most popular player in Team USA. And so in London, and I'm pretty sure if he's going to Brazil next year, he's probably going to be the most popular player in the Team USA. So, yes, he's the global icon, Mr. Basketball, and, you know, he will be missed.
So let me ask you about one controversy that does need mentioning, sexual assault charges leveled at Kobe Bryant by a hotel employee in Colorado in 2003, settled out of court. But when we talk about how Kobe resonated as a personality around the world, what is there to say about this incident? Did non-Americans pay attention?
Well, yeah, of course. When a big sports name kind of do something wrong, something that is perceived wrong, that kind of got global attention. But with Kobe, everyone here was with him. I mean, the allegations were tough and were bad for his reputation, but Kobe Bryant still managed to maintain all the fans he had. As soon as the season started, everyone was focusing back on what he did on the court and what he did off the court.
Davide, what do you think would surprise Americans the most about how Kobe is seen in some parts of the globe?
Here in Italy, for example, he's an icon, he's a legend. Even if you're a Celtics fan or, you know, a Clippers fan, a Knicks fan, that is something probably in the States is not so clear about him. You know, we have stories since 5:30 in the morning today about his retirement, and all I read from fans was like, congratulations, thank you for what you gave us. And, you know, there were a lot of fans who were writing, yeah, I'm a Celtic fan, but I still have the uttermost respect for Kobe. And I think this is something that when you go global, you kind of lost this team-by-team division, and you just appreciate the great players.
Yeah, Kobe Bryant, he is above team rivalries. Davide Cinnalato with La Gazzetta dello Sport in Milan. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And that's The World for this Monday. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.